Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Brought to the Table podcast. This is a podcast where a group of friends come together and they share things and they just don't stop talking. But they talk about things that are like fun or relevant or like kind of interesting. So for our cast, we have me, Diana Schulberg. I'll be freeloading this episode and facepalming while everybody keeps talking. We have Ian Walker, Carter Van Hus, Caitlin Phillips, and Scott Pruitt. All right, so you guys ready for trivia time?
No.
Wait. Can Scott just start going by Scott, like in the intro section, like Madonna or something?
Ooh, I like that.
Scott, are you Madonna?
I am. In fact, Madonna, you found me out.
We've solved your Madonna puzzle.
Yep. Guys, you did it. All right.
That's the one joke I'm going to make.
Okay. Soon. Alright, so trivia time. So, which big name Avengers actor is known for doing most of his own stunts?
You cut out.
I'm assuming it's stunts.
It's the boy. I know the name. It's the boy.
I got it.
It's Captain America.
Oh, no, I don't got it.
Actor's
oh, yeah,
name,
I do.
Oh, I got it.
Again.
Hold on.
I got it.
Chris Evans.
God damn it, I was ready for that.
Caitlin, I'll give it to you because you were, like, so passionate, and I love the passion.
Yes. I mean, they're the same.
Actually,
I was saying Chris Evans.
Huh?
Oh, Scott said it first. Okay. Well, yeah. We're the same team.
What's an Avengers movie?
There's a couple great pieces about him taking a lot of extra time when he's filming to learn how to do a bunch of, like, kicks. And the only stunts that he doesn't actually do are a lot of the more flippy ones. But for the most part, he actually does all his own stunts. It's really impressive.
I was reading about how he has a very unique, like, dancer-like way of running, so that whenever he's running, like, that's him, because they can't get a stunt double to do it, because it's like, no, it clearly looks like it's not you.
All right, so, Caitlin and Scott, what you got for us today? What are you bringing to the table?
All right, we are going to be talking about voiceover tech, virtual assistants, etc.
Interesting.
I'm going to go ahead and mute my Alexa for this. She doesn't need to hear this.
Yeah, I should too.
Wait, how many of us have an Alexa or, like, a voice assistant with us now?
Not me. With us now.
Is it just not me?
I mean, it's in the apartment. No, it's in your apartment.
This podcast recorded in front of a live studio audience.
A live studio Alexa.
There we go.
Welcome Alexa. To Alexa time.
Well, mine's unplugged, so and okay. I did, Alexa.
Alexa, play 1 Week by the Bare Naked Ladies.
No.
No, just... Alexa, don't do it.
There it is. Alexa. Stop.
Why did you
Alexa, don't.
Do a Snapchat?
Make
of
him
you
live in his hell.
This.
You made
okay,
this.
Well, okay, Scott and Caitlin, hit me up.
So, as Caitlin said, or as I'm about to say, if we edit that part out, we're going to be talking about voice assistants, speech recognition, and all the kind of advances in software and in consumer products that have come out recently. The, like, kind of big names being Amazon's Alexa or the like the Echo product line, the Echo Dot, the big Echo speaker, Google Home, pretty much the exact same thing but made by Google. Since I come from a software background, I'm going to talk a little bit about and hand wave my way around some of the software principles for people who don't know software. If you do know software, please fast forward for about 3 or 4 minutes so you don't be offended by this, or hear what I'm saying and know that I'm wrong. So there are basically two major parts if you're imagining this kind of pipeline in your head. There's speech to text, which is exactly as it sounds. Take speech, make a text. And then when you have that text, you need to understand what the text is. And it's kind of broken down because the two problem domains are both insanely complicated and have lots of, like, non-solved problems, or they're only solved partially, or, you know, people are still doing research in these areas. So, like, speech to text, you're taking audio waveforms, like, the most of us here are looking at Audacity and you see the little ups and downs. You literally take kind of amplitude frequency stuff and turn it into words, which is kind of insane when you think about how the brain does that. But I don't know anything about science other than software, so I'm not going to talk about that. The standalone version of this speech to text is used pretty widely, like Caitlin, I think, is going to talk about. Like, dictation software is a product in and of itself. I want to talk so I don't have to type. Voice keyboards are a thing on mobile that are actually pretty good now if you use one from, like, Google. This software, like, developing it requires, I said some of my notes, but a lot of knowledge of audio processing, and especially how speech actually works. Like, what are the motions we're making with our mouth, and how are they conveyed, and how does that actually translate into, you know, syllables and all that stuff? And modern algorithms for speech-to-text actually rely a lot on machine learning, which is basically statistical models that are taking samples, you know what they're saying, and you're training a computer to learn, kind of like a human brain does, just by hearing stuff over and over again and learning what it means. And they've gotten significantly better, all these algorithms, in, like, I'd say the last several years, because we've got more powerful machine learning techniques, along with companies that have enough training data and enough servers to chew through them to make, like, the correct models that fit data well enough. Second half, like I said, is natural language processing, natural language understanding, which is, now I have some text, what does it actually mean? It turns out some things you don't really need sophisticated software if you have good speech-to-text, like, you know, Alexa, turn on my lights. You don't need a machine learning algorithm. You just need to match, like, they said something about lights and they said the word on, and that's it. A monkey could almost do it. But they're rapidly getting better at complicated tasks, mostly due to machine learning, which is learning patterns in the way people are saying things. And more complicated models actually require intuition about the English language. Like, you can actually do sentence parsing and break things down more easily, which for English, if you've ever tried to, like, learn English grammar, it's stupidly hard. So lots of standalone tasks exist in natural language processing and understanding as well that are completely outside of what we're going to talk about today. Google kills at this, especially if you've ever been like, hey, find food near me or find a restaurant that's like this near me. You just type that into Google and it just pulls up the results. It's kind of crazy. But the last thing I want to say about this is they're not actually done as, like, a separate, they're not done in isolation. Like, each part interferes or interacts with each other, or their feedback loops. It's kind of hard to predict in isolation what each word is from just audio forms, but you may make a better prediction if you know what the previous word is. Like, if I say I'm going out to, it's probably likely the next word I say is eat and not feet.
I mean, you do you. No judgment here, buddy.
Did you have anything you want to add to that, Caitlin?
I had kind of a question. Do they have the same problem that I had when I was trying to learn German, in that I don't know, like, I couldn't tell when words stop and end?
Yeah, I think, so that's something that I think things are generally good at now. Like, if you go and watch a YouTube video, this is one of the cool things, you have the YouTube auto-generated captions, and they actually line it up with, like, how they're saying it in the video. So very sophisticated algorithms are pretty good at determining, like, where things take place in the audio. But there's definitely an element, like, in the human brain that's good at telling where words end and the next one starts based on the known vocabulary. And I think that's probably a problem for some algorithms. This is not my area of expertise, but
I feel like it has a lot to do with, like, the phoneme structure and, like, which different sounds actually are, like, a set in each language.
Yes.
Because, like, I know that's a big thing with different languages, is that, like, you don't have all of the phonemes of another language, or you might have ones that they don't have. And therefore, like, if you're trying to learn a language that has a phoneme that you have no prior exposure to, you are going to have a very difficult time actually trying to distinguish what that sound even is.
Yeah, and a lot of the algorithms, both for text-to-speech, which is, you know, I type something and a computer says it out to me, and speech-to-text, have, like, an internal stage where they're doing either phoneme recognition or translating words into phonemes and then turning those into the sounds. So there's, like, an internal breakdown between, okay, what did those, that, like, small section of the audio form, what are the possible phonemes for it, and then match it up to real words. That's how I know at least some text-to-speech work. And like I said, I don't know how the most sophisticated algorithms now work for speech-to-text, because it's so wildly complicated and nobody's perfect at it. But yeah, there's lots of both understanding how actual language structure works and then applying statistical models and sample data to that so that computers can learn a statistical model of it.
I see. Yeah, I was just curious because as you were talking, it reminded me of this one very specific language problem I had, but also I just, like, didn't try very hard at German, and I should have tried harder. So something that I have to talk about is kind of the history of virtual assistants, voice assistants, if you guys think that would be interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. In 1961, they developed the IBM Shoebox, which was then presented to the general public the following year at the Seattle World's Fair. It was able to recognize 16 spoken words and the digits 0 through 9, So that's like the vocabulary of a baby, which isn't particularly good. And then after that, the United States Department of Defense got a bit more involved with Carnegie Mellon University, and they developed this tool called Harpy, which mastered about 1,000 words, which is the vocabulary of a 3-year-old. And that was in the 1970s. I think I jumped over that accidentally. Dragon launched Dragon Dictate in the 1990s, like 1992, I think, which was the first speech recognition product for consumers, which was $6,000, which is insane. You guys remember Clippy. He can't hear you, but he's an important boy.
The most sexist computer.
He was around. He was around. When was Clippy around?
Forever.
Like 1998 or something. Yeah, until later. Let's see. Microsoft tried to include speech recognition software in Office XP in the mid-2000s, but, you know, it wasn't super advanced. And then as you get into this past decade, you get all of the big exciting things, like IBM's Watson wins at Jeopardy, Apple introduces Siri, Google launches, Google. Microsoft builds Cortana. There's Amazon skill sets and all these exciting things. And I also found this article from 2016 that said that computers, which have already beaten us at chess, Jeopardy, and Go, that board game, have also now beaten us at typing. So for a long time, voice recognition would misunderstand us as we were talking, and it was just faster to just pull out your phone and type anyway. But, kind of like Scott said, that's actually something that we're getting pretty good at. And, in 2016, there was a competition, there was a competition, a Baidu program called Deep Speech 2 against 32 humans, age 19 to 32. Okay, I just said 32 way too many times. I thought I was, like, having a stroke.
Fast. Face. Arm. Speech.
32.
Time to call a doctor.
32? Anyway, they did it with short phrases like buckle up for safety and wear a crown with many jewels and this person is a disaster, which seems kind of like they're dissing us.
That an actual phrase?
Yes, that was a phrase.
That's a very important phrase. Like, come on, if there's gonna be like robots that take over everything and they're gonna be able to talk to us while they're doing it, I fucking want them to be sassy. Like, if you don't have sassy robots, I'm done with it.
That's true. Anyway, and then in this specific thing with Deep Speech 2 versus these 32 humans, the voice recognition software was 3 times faster, which is very exciting. But yet, Alexa and Siri are still going to misunderstand you a lot of the time, is the unfortunate thing. Google Home is much better at answering your questions, but Siri still gets easily befuddled, and so does Alexa.
So I just wanted to take kind of the history and go into the main consumer products that are out now. I think the big one most people are familiar with is Echo or Alexa. So Echo is kind of the thing you buy, and Alexa is the software, I guess, is how they're branding it. I have 2 Echo Dots, and I actually love them. Locally, it does wake word detection, so you say Alexa, and it's like, oh, did you say Alexa? And then it starts shipping all the audio you're saying to some servers, the very fancy software that I guess they call Alexa. They determine what you say, and they take actions based on it. I mostly use it for being a lazy shit, so I use it to turn my lights off and on. I use it to turn my TV off and on, especially if I'm, like, walking into my living room and I've got, like, you know, a burrito in my hands, and I don't want to turn on the lights with the switch because I got a burrito in my hands. I actually use it...
because you've got 3 burritos in your hands.
You gotta be 3 deep in
burritos. How many hands do you think he has?
I just have burrito hands.
3 deep in burritos.
He has 32 burritos.
So I also use it as my primary alarm clock. So I don't have to wake up at a specific time to get into work every day, so if I ever want to wake up, I usually am just like, hey, Alexa, wake me up at 9:30 a.m. because it's like inside. 2 a.m. right now, and that gives me roughly enough sleep. And whenever I wake up, I'm like, hey, Alexa, what's the weather? And she'll be like, it's fucking hot out. Wear shorts. She doesn't actually say it like that. She tells me that it's like 63 and it'll be a high of 81 or something. So I don't use it for anything fancy. You can use it to play music, of course, which I use, but not like every day. There's some integration with other Amazon products, like you can have it play stuff on your Fire TV. All that stuff is really useful. It's not like a life-changing thing. It mostly just means I can be more lazy and not hit buttons on things that are far away. The good feature about Alexa is also it's in the Amazon Fire TV remote, and I think you can get it on the app as well. So like you can just say, hey, play Netflix, or hey, play this TV show, and you don't have to like try and search for the stupid Amazon Fire remote, which makes you just like, you know, use the virtual keyboard. Google Assistant, pretty much the exact same thing, but a different platform. So Google's got, you know, a built-in speaker. They do wake word detection when you say, okay, Google, and then ship your data to some server. Server finds out what you're saying, figures out what it should do based on what you're saying. The platform is pretty different, and in terms of like software, it seems more impressive, and it can do more complicated tasks with it can take on more stuff. Amazon's kind of we have a bunch of features that you trigger with some keywords and it works well. Google seems like more natural, but they don't have as many integrations with popular smart home products and stuff, at least the last time I checked. I think both of them are fairly good. The price points, if you're getting an Echo, like the big Echo and the Google Assistant, are roughly similar because they're competing with each other and fixing the prices. But yeah, both of them I think are really cool, and they're showing an example of where they kind of give me a hint as to what it could be. But because the recognition and integrations with stuff isn't like all the way baked yet and it's still improving, I think it's not an end game, right? The stuff is going to get better and it's going to get cooler and probably more mainstream as time goes on.
So that's actually really interesting, you know, the way you phrase that as the current state of voice assistants being sort of like a jumping off point, sort of actually where I consider VR to be right now. It's a very similar technology progression in my mind. And what I sort of have noticed or really know about the sort of business strategies that Amazon and Google are taking, they're taking two wildly different strategies. Primarily, the Google Assistant is, like Caitlin said, really targeted towards providing valuable content. You know, if I ask a question, it should be able to answer that without having me, you know, really think about how I ask it. If I ask it, you know, what time this place opens, is like, oh, well, it opens at this time, and you know, it'll give you a little more information that you would actually want to know based on the context of your question. Whereas the Amazon Echo has really, really sort of been quantity, not quality. They've opened up the Amazon Echo software system. I'm deliberately not saying Alexa because she can hear me right now, and I forgot to turn it off. She can hear me, yeah.
Alexa,
she can't
order a pizza.
She can't hear you. You know that, right?
Alexa, delete all Dave's.
Okay.
See, that's when you just switch it to Echo, and you're fine.
My point being that the Echo really has... You can find Echo anything. There's Echo integrated refrigerators. There's Echo integrated thermostats. There's Echo integrated, and by Echo integrated, I literally mean Echo as in the hardware. It functions as the actual Echo, and so it's given these people these third party opportunities to get into that ecosystem. Whereas Google has been really driving towards not the integrations, not that sort of thing, but definitely towards the quality of their assistant. Because it's also the same assistant that they use on Android phones, and so they really want to have that connection be viable for cross-platform usage.
Yeah, I just wanted to try and summarize what you're saying. So, like, I think the Echo is actually a better product now in terms of it is more useful, but you can kind of think of the Echo as it exists today, or at least how most people are using it, as a voice remote. Our remote's got a lot of buttons, it can do a lot of things, but the things it does are simple, like turn the volume up or down, so on and so forth. Google Assistant has some functionality like that, but they're kind of driving it forward to be an actual assistant, because they want people to be, they want that to be the primary interface for a lot of things. And so I think I really agree with you how you said it's kind of, they're at a part where they can monetize this. It's like VR. People will buy this, but they're not in everybody's hands. They're not like everybody's using it all the time. And I think they, like Amazon is trying to cash in on this now, where they're like, this is definitely a profitable thing. And it seems like Google wants to get in the market, and they're maybe not as concerned with profit right now. I don't actually know if Assistant is profitable, but it seems like they're more investing in the technology, whereas Amazon is investing in making a product.
Yeah, so your point about the monetization of these platforms really comes into play more with Google, at least in terms of how we've set up what they do, you know, as opposed to the Echo being more of a remote type product, which in and of itself actually takes a fair amount of at least tech savviness to get your home set up to use. But with Google and in the future when it gets a little bit better, Echoes, the primary monetization, I imagine, and honestly, to me, an ethical quandary is going to be the, hey, Google, what's the best Mexican place to eat? Because if you Google what the best Mexican place to eat is, you'll get a list. You know, you'll get a list. But your Google and your Echo will only give you one result, right? And so how do they decide that? How do they, is that monetizable? How do they determine the best Mexican restaurant within a, you know, 20-mile radius?
Oh, hell yeah. That's definitely going to be on there. And I imagine, so there are actually, like, laws in various places that determine, like, you can't just say in Google, like, you say Mexican places. You'll get things that say, like, sponsored. Like, you get, if it is clearly an ad, like, somebody paid for it,
yeah,
it has to be clearly labeled as an ad. It's the same thing on most platforms now. So I imagine the laws are still going to have to apply. They're not going to be able to, like, sidestep that. So they have to say sponsored content, you know, Mama's Tacos next door, or Mama's Tacos 3 miles away, or the much better place next door
that has so much Mama's money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so like that's conceptually that's wild to me, because you know they've got to create a user interface, you know, even though it's not a graphical user interface, it is like these are user interfaces, that's all that they are. And so they've got to create this user interface in a way that is enjoyable to use, because if this thing becomes unenjoyable to use, it immediately gets dropped because it is not a core component of your life.
Yeah, and they really need to build that up to become a core component of their lives so they can kind of take a commanding lead in the market, right? Like Amazon and Google, and Microsoft's kind of in there with Cortana, and you know there are a couple mm-hmm. other stragglers in the market. They really want to get in there, so they're like in people's brains when they've got like that killer product that everybody's going to want to buy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Does anybody else have questions? Otherwise, I think we've talked enough about this.
Oh, I have one more question. I have one more question for, I think this is going to be a Scott question. No offense, Caitlin. So Scott, you mentioned earlier that like in the past couple of years, the technology has really exploded. And I know this, and you know this, and maybe our listeners do too. I know this, you know this, and this is important information to the question. It's because this the hardware to do this processing has taken off substantially. And I know that that's the case, but I don't know what did that. You know, I don't know what that hardware is. I just know that it's better suited for this use. Can you elaborate on that if you know anything?
I don't think it's like a hardware thing. It's more mm-hmm. so like machine learning has existed for forever. It's the most simple thing is you can imagine if you're predicting house prices, you pull out a best fit line and you put the size of the house on one axis and the cost on the other one. That's dumb machine learning. It's linear regression. The algorithms that are doing this are a lot more complicated, but they're not like completely magic. They're just taking data, finding a model that fits it in some complicated way. It's not like linear or even polynomial or something like that. It's more that some of these algorithms have actually existed for a while. They were just kind of discarded as very expensive. But like a couple of key things have happened. One, we've brought back some of these algorithms and we've actually applied them like just modern optimization techniques. Like, oh, this algorithm does like a lot of math and it turns out that math was really expensive. But now I realize we can do this math on GPUs and GPU hardware is getting very, very good. It's that's the one that's really exploding. Like, CPUs are getting better at tens of percents maybe a year, if that. GPUs are still getting like linear over a couple years performance improvements, which is insane. And they're also getting like, they're all still pretty power efficient, and they're coming out even with specialized kind of GPU hardware that is just to do these machine learning problems. The other thing is, we now have companies that have like enough hardware to do this on their own time and make it profitable, like Google and Amazon, right? So they've got enough data, because Google has been training the voice keyboard for forever, however long that's taken. And they have a vested interest in like making this good, because they know it'll be profitable in the future. And they have a model that lets them not do it on the client side. Because they have all these servers, all they need is something that can do wake word detection, which is a slightly easier problem. It's still kind of like speech to text, but you don't have to be as accurate. And you're only looking for one specific thing to train on. And then they've got all these servers that they can send all the data off to. And they've got all the specialized techniques, and they can actually use that to improve it, right? Because since they're getting all the stuff in-house, they're sending all of your audio once you say, hey, Alexa, what is blank? And they can keep training it as it comes on. And that's kind of the, I don't know, I don't want to call it the beauty of machine learning, but it gets better as time goes on. It's not going to like become Skynet or anything. It just means you get more data. More data means you can train it to fit the data better.
And there's a whole bunch of ramifications behind, you know, the collection of data and the methodologies behind the collection of data. And I have a lot of questions about machine learning as well, but I think that's going to have to be its own episode.
We'll do another one on data collection and stuff. I just have one more thing. There are like people are coming up with new algorithms that are actually really cool. The problem is a lot of them are like, it turns out like doing the simple thing on a lot of data is actually sometimes better than doing the complicated thing. So it's kind of a toss up. I have no idea what the state of the art is in this, but things are getting better because of both a combination of new software techniques, optimizations of old software techniques for new hardware, and better hardware.
All right. All right, everybody. So we're gonna take a quick break, and while we're on our break, listen to some wonderful music by our local in-house artist, which totally changes every time. And if you can't find the subtle changes, then you just aren't listening hard enough.
That's part of our ARG.
Yep. Consider
we're not supposed to let them know about that yet.
If you found the changes, let us know and email us at brought to the table@gmail.com. I haven't found any yet, but it's like Waldo, man. You just got to try.
Listen, if you play it backwards and also close your eyes and also don't listen to it, you can hear something.
I hope everybody had a good time and ate a ton of cheese, because I know that's what we were all doing in this break period of time. We were having regular cheese and vegan cheese, and we'll learn more about vegan cheese on a later day. But right now,
I think we learned about vegan cheese on a previous
day. No, we didn't learn enough about specifically vegan cheese. We need to know more.
All right.
But for now, we have Ian and Carter. What you got for us, guys? What do you bring into the table?
So we've gone from like a very, very recent technology that's really exciting. It's got a lot of cool stuff to like a really, really old one. Today we're going to be talking about cast iron cookware.
How old exactly?
Old as Hella. Shit.
Old as balls.
Yeah.
Old as Ian?
You know how old? I don't know.
Was Ian there when it was first invented? Because I would buy that.
Probably.
I mean, I'm not allowed to comment on the different times just because of, you know, I get in trouble for that. But I want to say it's like the first mentioning of it that I've found has been in English. Well, in English was in like the 679 or 680 AD.
That's early as hell.
That was a cast iron kettle because, you know, of course the fucking English would have the first mention of a kettle.
Well, I've also seen, I don't have years, but there's also been a lot of cast iron use in Chinese.
Yes.
I was gonna say Chinese.
China, cultures. India, China. Japan, yeah. Korea. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of use of like cast iron vessels.
Yeah. So let's first talk about like what cast iron is, because like it's very popular. So you probably know what I'm talking about, and if you don't, then
where the hell have you been?
Yeah. What not cast iron rock have you been living under?
Once
I describe it, you'll probably know what I'm talking about. Cast iron cookware is a style of cookware that is made by casting molten iron into cookware. That's pretty much it. I mean, it's different from wrought iron, which is hammered out, and you know, it's not made of stainless steel or anything like that. It's iron. Most popular today, you'll see skillets. I cooked in a cast iron skillet. Literally, how long have we been recording? 42 minutes. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. 43 minutes ago, I was cooking in a cast iron skillet. You also will see Dutch ovens, which, like, you know, you'll take camping, or you will just have over an open fire, really, you know, used in ye olden days. There's also some more things that I don't personally use. There's like griddles, and then like grill grates, you know, are made of cast iron often. Woks are made of cast iron a lot. And then also, like Ian said, kettles, tea kettles, teapots, all sorts of stuff like that.
Bathtubs.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's sort of just a general overview of what we're talking about today. But Ian, you want to go into like why do we use cast iron?
Because it's awesome, hands down. One of my favorite things to really like actually cook in is a cast iron skillet. Unfortunately, I do not have one with me. There is one that my parents have at home, and anytime that it gets used, I pretty much love whatever it comes out of it. The best thing about it is the fact that you can pretty much cook anything in it. Do you want to make a chocolate chip cookie? You can do that. Do you want to do a pizza? Also, you can do that. What about a steak? You can do that. How about, like, potatoes? You can cook potatoes in there. Anything. You can pretty much cook in an oven or in a pan or anything. You can cook on a cast iron skillet or a cast iron cookware device, essentially.
Hell yeah.
It's just, they're really, really good for a large assortment of things, mainly because of the way that they're able to hold heat and disperse it among itself. So, like, it's a very even sort of cooking device. I know that there's a lot of pans that we have currently in our kitchen that if you leave food in one section of it, it's going to burn a lot faster than anywhere else in the pan. And that is such a pain in the ass. Cast iron, I've never had that problem with it. It's just hands down one of my favorite things to cook with.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Cast iron, in like more scientific terms to what Ian was saying, actually has, or well, iron in general has a fairly high specific heat, as compared to something like stainless steel, especially because cast iron is normally like, I don't know, would you say like half an inch thick? Between a quarter and half an inch thick.
Yeah, they're about. I mean, I think it depends mainly on whether you're using a skillet or if it's something like a Dutch oven or like a griddle.
Precisely. And because there's so much material, one, it takes a long time to heat up, which is not great if you know, are in a hurry. But if you've got the time, which, you know, if you're using cast iron, you better. And we'll get to why in a second. But if you've got the time and you properly... You know, you take your time, heat the cast iron. It heats the whole thing all the way through, and it retains that heat. So even if you turn off the burner, that cast iron skillet's going to retain its heat for a lot longer, just because of the material that you're using to cook. Again, that's just because it's got a high specific heat, so it has to. You put in a lot of energy, and it disperses that energy slowly while heating up the surroundings pretty effectively. I was going to say something. I forgot. Okay. Right. So, one thing that Ian said that I super love about cast iron is that you can use it for anything. Ian specifically mentioned steaks and oh my God, I love to cook steaks in cast iron. And the reason for that is because there's not a lot of things that you can use to cook stovetop and in the oven. And so, like, my personal recipe is, like, throw a steak on, you know, a very hot cast iron skillet for 4 minutes while you've preheated the oven to 400 degrees. And then after that 4 minutes, flip it, throw it in the oven for 5 minutes, and then it's done. Like, that's the whole thing. And there's just very little, very, very, very few cooking supplies.
Cookware.
Yeah, there we go. That you can use to do something like that with.
It also, it really cuts down on how much you have to clean afterwards, which we'll get into that in a little bit, like how to actually prepare, well, not prepare, but how to clean your cast iron cookware. But, like, having one dish that you can use on the stovetop, in the oven, over a fire pit, like, come on. I can't really take a lot of the pots and pans that I have and just take them out to a fire pit and be good.
So Carter might have already answered this already, but just in case not. So between the two of you, what is your favorite thing that you have cooked in a cast iron, product, dish, cookware? And what do you think is the best dish? Like, what do you think is, like, the best thing to cook in there, like, versus your favorite thing?
All right, so I got a couple answers for you. Best thing to cook in cast iron? Bacon. Fine, like, just flat out, it's bacon. You throw bacon in there, it's just, like, you cook it very well, and we'll get into it later, like we've said, like, four times now. But it, doing that also sort of helps you care for the cast iron as well, which is, like, a weird thing to say, like, that cooking in it will help the cast iron.
You've got to love the cast iron in order for it to, like, properly cook.
Yeah. And then my favorite thing to cook, so that's, like, the best thing to cook in it. It's a good thing that you phrase your question that way, because, like, I do think that there's two different answers. Mm-hmm. But my favorite thing to cook in it, I actually made for you guys last weekend over Memorial Day weekend when we were, you know, hanging out, doing our thing, you know.
The company retreat.
The company retreat, and it's cornbread. Cornbread's super easy to make. If you've got well-seasoned cast iron, it doesn't stick or anything. You just throw that bad boy in there, and it's good to go. And there's so much variety that you can put on cornbread. It's just, love it.
Yeah, like, I really have to agree with Carter on the second choice that he has of, like, his favorite thing. Honestly, anything that's a bread-based dish, so things like cornbread, like Carter said, but also, like, any sort of cobbler is just amazing. Just cannot compete, in my book, with, like, a cobbler that's made in a cast iron skillet or a Dutch oven or anything like that. It's just so much better than any other form of a cobbler. Pot pies are also amazing. Just, again, anything that's got bread in it just comes out so much better. I honestly, I don't know how to describe it. It's one of those you have to try it yourself, and you'll understand that it's very hard to put that into words.
All right, so is it time? Is it time for us to discuss
the moment we've all been waiting for?
The secrets.
Do you
think that they're ready to learn how to properly care and love and nurture their cast iron?
I don't know.
Is the cast iron like a Tamagotchi where you constantly have to love it?
Yes.
I mean, actually, yes. It kind of is.
Definitely is. cast iron Tamagotchi. Name of the episode, right there. Oh man. But yeah, so cast iron, if you know your chemistry, but you don't know your cast iron, you're going to sit here and think, huh, cooking with iron, like just straight iron, not any alloy or anything, that sounds like a horribly dumb idea. Because, as most of us know, iron rusts, and it
rusts
bad. Iron's
also bad for you if you have too much.
Yes, absolutely. But iron, if you're familiar with oxidation, which is rusting, heat really quickens up the process of oxidation. Heat and water both really speed that up. And so why would you choose iron as a cooking surface if all you're doing is heating it up and adding liquids and all sorts of nasty stuff to it? That'll just make it degrade. And the reason is because when you use it, it's not just iron. You've actually seasoned the pan with a layer of oil that has been heated and polymerized into a very thin but very strong layer of hydrophobic surface that that essentially just, like, is what separates the food from the iron.
Which, honestly, was something that I didn't know exactly how it worked with, like, interacting with the oxidation, because that's not really my strong suit of, like, knowing chemistry and how this stuff really interacts.
Ain't
I know that
either, boy.
I was gonna say, like, I knew that, like, iron and water and oxygen, that's bad. And then also, like, causing issues where, like, iron would leach into food. Like, you know, old cans, they used to have an issue with that, where the iron and lead from cans would leach into canned food. And, hey, that's bad for you. And then, like, looking into this, and then also, like, what Carter just said, the fact that you season it, and, like, the reason for that is to prevent that leaching and oxidation from happening, is just interesting. Like, who came up with this?
So we've mentioned seasoning a couple of times. Would you mind going into the process of, like, how seasoning happens and, like, what you actually physically do to this big old hunk of metal?
All right. So, as Carter had said, seasoning involves a layer of, like, oils and fats that are basically coating the inside of your cast iron pan, skillet, whatever. What it does is you essentially have a base, which is going to be, like, your animal fat, animal oil, vegetable oil, if, you know, that's your thing. And you cook that onto your cast iron cookware. The whole point of it is you're creating that barrier. You do this roughly, you know, about, I don't know, how often do you guys do yours? Because, like, I know whenever I've used mine, I do that, like, after cleaning it, you do it every time that I've used it.
Yeah, so I'm a bad boy, and I don't season mine every time. I try to, but I forget. And that's actually why I said, like, if you're going to use cast iron, you better have the time to both, one, it's going to take a while to heat, and two, the aftercare, because it's a kinky sumbitch.
Carter, the bad boy of the podcast on many levels.
That was so smooth.
But anyways, the aftercare is really important, because it by cooking it, you have degraded the surface, and you need to, like, re-up your stuff, you know?
And, like, I feel like aftercare very much does sum that up very well. What you're basically going to do is you're going to take that fat or oil, you're going to cook it in your pan. It's going to be, like, set upside down, and you're going to drain it. It's going to be about an hour. Then you're going to bake it in the oven for about 350 degrees for about 30 minutes. Most of the time, you might find cast iron stuff, if you're buying it from a store that's just made it or is, like, still selling it where it's, like, fresh from the factory, most of them come pre-seasoned. However, if you're getting a old cast iron cookware piece, definitely make sure that you season it before you cook it ever.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, you always want to make sure that it has been seasoned before you cook it. Otherwise, you're gonna ruin it. The other thing is acidic foods are something else to watch out for. So tomatoes are very bad. Remove the seasoning that you've put and, like, spent time on. Remove it so fast. So goddamn fast. I think something that we didn't actually talk about on was the enamel cast iron.
Yeah. I got a few more things to say about the seasoning first, and then let's hit some of this, the fucking, like, remixes of cast iron, you know.
Oh, fair.
Yeah,
the flavors of cast iron.
Yeah. Oh man, I'm about to drop some fucking, like, how about that words on you. So first, you said that you've seasoned your cast iron in the oven for about 30 minutes at 350 degrees. I've always done it at 450 degrees at one
Ooh,
hour.
Really?
Yeah. And I don't know the science behind that, and that's, like, that's part of what makes cast iron so fucking weird. It's just that, like, it's such a like, passed down sort of knowledge. And this is something I really wanted to touch on, is that cast iron is sort of, or it's not even sort of, it's just very important in the American South. It is just a cultural part of it. Like, it's a part of the culture. Like, my mother handed my cast iron down to me. She got her a cast iron, which was a different one, handed down to her from her mother. Like, it's a thing. like in the American South, and not only is the actual physical piece, but like learning how to care for it, because like we've already detailed, it's not just like throw it in the dishwasher. In fact, that is the worst thing that you could do, because you'll destroy it.
Yeah, don't put it in the dishwasher. But there are like legitimate ways to look up how to season it. It's not, you don't, if you don't have family mythology and you do want to buy cast iron, don't worry, there's
nope,
the internet.
You can only have cast iron if you've got a family.
It's got to be passed down from the ancients along with the proper spells.
Hey, that's my grandma you're talking about.
I thought we were talking about Ian, but that's cool too.
Oh, so, excuse you.
One thing, you know, I made a joke about Ian saying the different flavors of cast iron. When cast iron is first created and before it's been seasoned really heavily, cast iron is very porous, and that's sort of what makes it very receptive to the seasoning. And so, as you season it for the first couple of times, and even if you do get a pre-seasoned one, you definitely want to just keep re-seasoning it really hard, you know, and really build that seasoning, get a very smooth, very hydrophobic layer of polymerized oils on there. But as you do that for the first couple of times, you're going to be noticing that your food takes on the flavor of whatever you're seasoning it with. So if you season it with bacon fat or bacon grease, then you're going to get a bacon grease flavored pancake the next time you make a pancake in there.
Seriously, there is nothing better than like frying potatoes in a cast iron skillet that has been seasoned with bacon grease.
Absolutely. I 100%
best breakfast
agree.
Food there is ever.
Oh my gosh, I know, and that's part of the things that I love about cast iron is that you can like you can taste what's going on, which not necessarily great, and we'll talk about that in a bit.
It can go wrong if you don't take care of it.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's another thing about cast iron. If you care for it right, it'll last forever. I mean, just literally decades. If you care for it wrong, you're going to destroy it. If you don't season it and keep an eye on it, you'll notice that, oh, shoot, you've got spots in your cast iron, and it's starting to rust. Like right now, I've got to actually re-season the bottom of my cast iron because it's starting to show some bare spots. So I need to re-season the bottom of that so that I don't destroy my cast iron. It's just like the fact that it like exists for so long with proper care, you know, you've got some pans that are made of stainless steel that like, oh, they'll get dings and dents and then the Teflon will scrape off. And it's like, well, this is dangerous for me to keep eating with, you know, because now it's got like plastic shit floating around in it. I need to throw this away. If you do your cast iron right, that will never happen.
If you take care of your cast iron, it will take care of you.
That's 100%. Yep. So anyways, about that enamel.
Yeah, so enamel is an interesting thing because like I've seen enamel cast iron before and just never put it together that was enamel cast iron. It was just another type of cookware to my head because it doesn't look what I imagine cast iron to be. I imagine, you know, your stereotypical cast iron skillet normally that has like the entire piece is one big hunk of metal. Enamel cast iron can look very different from that as it is coated with that enamel cover like coating, and it allows it to go without being seasoned or cleaned in the same way that your regular cast iron is. The enamel is essentially a built-in seasoned layer. The enamel can be like multiple different colors if you want to get like some good design up in your kitchen. That's cool. But, like, the main thing that I think that the enamel brings in is the fact that you don't have to season, and you can actually clean it with water and soap if you so desire. But you lose that sort of flavor that you would get with the bare cast iron that has that seasoned layer on it. And I think it's all just sort of a, what would you prefer? Would you prefer easier clean and preparation, or would you prefer to have like that after flavor that you've been preparing for months?
Yeah, and enameled cast iron, I think the reason that it's not more prevalent is because it's such a recent development. If I'm not mistaken, it's something that came around in like the 50s and the 60s. You know, you can imagine
that sounds about right.
50s home with all these bright orange and blues, you know, that's sort of what, you know, the aesthetic of cast iron or enameled cast iron is. And really, the reason that you...
Some of those did have lead.
I believe it.
Yeah, that...
Red Fiesta ware from the 70s and before. But if it's anything else, you're fine. Don't worry about your Fiesta ware. But red or orange, I think. 1970s and before.
I really want to make a joke about it being, like, not Fiesta ware, but Siesta ware. But, like, that's sleepwear.
That's murder.
That's just somewhere else.
The reason that the enamel cast iron is used is for the same reason that cast iron bathtubs exist that are also coated in enamel and paint and whatnot, and it's because it retains heat well. You know, that is one of the most significant draws of cast iron at all, and so that's the whole reason that enameled cast iron exists as its own entity.
Yeah, also an enameled cast iron bathtub makes a lot more sense than a bare cast iron bathtub that you have to season. That just sounds disturbing and horribly, like, I'm very upset that I have thought of this.
Yeah, it's a laborious process to season just a skillet.
Well, I'm just thinking of actually taking a bath in a cast iron bathtub that you have seasoned with, like, fat or oil and have cooked it. Like, that's not clean.
That's called a stew. So... I was gonna take some time, and we were gonna talk a little bit about the cleanliness of it, but honestly, we're really over right now.
Yeah.
So I think we'll just have to save that for another day, or potentially in the extended episode description. So you can visit our website, broughttothetable.com, and we'll try to put some notes up about cleanliness and health and iron leaching and what have
and
you.
And lucky iron fish.
And yeah, lucky iron
and
fish.
How iron and, keeps out the fairies.
And how iron keeps out the fairies. Sure, I just hit them with my cast iron skillet and then they leave.
I mean, it works. They have, you know, you have Rapunzel in the newest, like, Disney movies that uses a skillet. Then you also have Samwise Gamgee from Lord
true.
Of the Rings that
the
also
princess.
Uses a skillet. Come on, what better cookware can you have that not only doubles as a something to use on your, like, stovetop, in your oven, in your fireplace, or to brain your enemies?
I do know somebody who has actually clobbed somebody with a cast iron skillet. They did not have a good time.
Does anybody have any more questions for Ian and Carter?
We're done.
All right. Well, now we have to we should upgrade our table to, like, cast iron table.
A level 3 stainless steel table.
So this was another fun one. If you have some thoughts on cast iron recipes or ways to use cast iron, please feel free to email us at broughttothetable@gmail.com. We love hearing all your stories, all your recipes, and if you have any, like, suggestions, ideas, things that you want to bring to the table, you can find us there. You can also find us on Facebook and Tumblr at Brought to the Table, or Twitter at To the Table Pod. Please leave a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasting goods at. Wherever you find your good podcast life at.
Target?
Yeah, Target. Yep. Sponsored
Walmart.
By Target.
Shit, I need to go there more then.
Not sponsored by Target. If you want to give us money, we'll be open to that. But subscribe to us. Don't miss an episode. And thank you for coming to the brand new cast iron voice activated table.